This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We just finished an hour of Congressman Mark Pocan taking your calls for the hour in our Middays with Mark. He is the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. It was a fascinating conversation. On the line with us now is Professor Richard Wolff. Dr. Wolff is the economist and co-founder of Democracy at Work. democracyatwork.info is the website. His website, his personal website is rdwolff with two Fs.com. His most recent book, Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, and you can tweet him at Prof. Wolff with two Fs. Dr. Wolff, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
I would love to get your thoughts on a conversation that I had last week with Steve Keen, an economist who you may be familiar with.
Yes.
I've known Steve for many years. And he pointed out how Japan, some more than 20 years ago, basically ended recessions by going into an economy that no longer had boom and bust cycles by virtue of regulation through their central bank. So it was just kind of a 20, you know, a couple of decades of basically sluggish growth. But the Japanese people didn't object so much to that because they still have a strong social safety net and all that kind of stuff, you know, free health care and all that. And he was speculating that, you know, given the head of the Fed?
Mr. Powell.
Yeah, Jay Powell's he stopped raising interest rates and he's continuing. And now I see these two articles in today's Financial Times. One's headlined, will the ECB, the European Central Bank, ever be able to abandon monetary stimulus? And the other is ECB unveils fresh bank stimulus amid rising Eurozone gloom. And which leads me to wonder if Steve Keen's analysis could even apply to the Eurozone. What are your thoughts on that? On what Japan did, how that might apply to us? They did this after their debt to GDP ratio exceeded 200%. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that this is a basic problem of capitalism, and it really afflicts the United States every bit as much as Japan, if not more so. Every employer is always looking for ways to save on labor costs, whether it's by hiring immigrants rather than local people, whether it's replacing people with machines through automation, whether it's making workers work harder and faster so he can do with fewer of them. Whatever it is, it's an endless struggle. And the profitability of an enterprise depends on how well he does it. But here's the irony, or if you like, the contradiction. The less money you put in the hands of the mass of workers who are employees, the less, of course, they can spend. And the irony is, you as a capitalist employer not only have to make profit by keeping your wage bill down, but you also have to sell the stuff that you hired the workers to help you produce. And if you deprive the mass of people of decent incomes, well, they can't buy it back from you. And that can be as debilitating to your profits as having paid them better wages in the first place. No capitalism I'm aware of has ever figured out how to resolve that contradiction. For a while, you can do it by having a kind of mass middle class type of capitalism. And we had that in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But as you proliferate a more and more unequal economic system, as we have in the last 30 years, more and more money is in the hands of a fewer portion of our population. They don't spend it the way other people who are less well endowed with money could do. And so there you have the problem. You have squeezed the mass of people. They can't buy the stuff you're producing, and that then grinds your economy down. What the Japanese did is face that and use the government to try to fix that situation by redistributing wealth, by having a very generous public service system, etc., etc. The United States seems hell-bent to not go in that direction. The people at the top don't want to give up even a portion of all that they have had redistributed to them in the last 30 years. So we seem to be heading down a path where we're unwilling to do the kinds of things the Japanese are doing, now apparently unwilling to do even what the Europeans are doing faced with this situation. And my guess is we're going to be very, very sorry that we're taking that extreme conservative path.
So by maintaining low interest rates right now, the Fed is, in effect, encouraging more and more debt, encouraging people, you know, stimulating the economy by encouraging people to borrow in order to buy things. And the European Central Bank looks like it's doing the same thing. And this is something that is eventually going to bite us in the butt. I think Steve pointed out that the private debt, even in Japan, was like over 200% of GDP, and they got it down to 160% of GDP by just kind of holding, you know, basically slowing down the economy, but not throwing it into reverse through the central bank. So it sounds to me like you're suggesting that our problems are so much deeper than Japan's because we don't have a strong social safety net and we don't have high minimum wages like Japan does, heavy levels of the equivalent of unionization, that therefore a crash is inevitable here and it'll be a crash that's driven by debt. Am I getting that right?
Yes, it's driven by debt and driven by these extremes because we don't allow the social safety net to function here in the way that it does already in Europe. I mean, just to give you a simple example, Europe has very high unemployment. So how do they survive? Well, when they go get to be unemployed, they still maintain their health insurance because it's not linked to their job. It's a national service available to everybody who's in France, everybody who's a French citizen. So to lose your job does not immediately plunge you into anxiety or deprivation when it comes to your health care. The same is applicable to school fees, even at higher levels of education. All of these kinds of programs have been eviscerated in the United States, if not eliminated altogether. So here, the inequality produces the kind of extreme economic tension that is you can feel across our country. Look, it is doing it in Europe, too, because despite the fact that they have a social safety net, the extremes of inequality there are pinching their people. And part of the reason the European Central Bank is doing what it's doing is directly connected to the Yellow Vest movement in France, where you've now had 3 or 4 months of weekly demonstrations across the country where the basic demand is we can't tolerate the level of inequality that this economy has brought us to.
Yeah, and thus neoliberalism. Thank you so much for your insights into this. It just makes so much sense. Professor Richard Wolff, the economist and co-founder of Democracy at Work, democracyatwork.info, rdwolff with two Fs.com, and you can tweet him at profwolff. Professor Wolff, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Glad to do it, and have a good week, Tom.
Thanks, and I look forward to our next conversation. We'll be right back. It's 14 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more of your calls and the news of the day in just a moment. And welcome back. Just wanted to give you an update on what's going on with Saudi Arabia. There is so much news associated right now with the Saudis that, John Abizaid is the retired general who was nominated to be Trump's first ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And he went before Congress yesterday and basically, and I'm sure, Bob Ney will be telling us about this during the news break. Coming up in a little bit, in about a half hour. It turned into what Bob Ney described as a bipartisan rant against Saudi Arabia's gangster-like abuses. They pressed Abizaid on the kingdom's domestic repression, lashings, electrocutions, beatings, whippings, sexual abuse, raids, the alleged detention and torture of activists and royal family members, and most recently the torture of a U.S. citizen. And, not to mention this devastating war with Yemen and cutting diplomatic and investment relations with Canada because they called out the kingdom on their human rights, ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, kidnapped the prime minister of Lebanon, triggered a spat between the Gulf allies that undermines U.S. Efforts. Marco Rubio said about Mohammed bin Salman, he's gone full gangster. This is the Republican senator from Florida. He says he's gone full gangster and it's difficult to work with a guy like that. Meanwhile, Europeans, Canada, and Australia, this was all 28 European Union members plus Canada and Australia. The only really fully developed country that's lacking from this list is the United States. just passed a resolution in the United Nations calling on Saudi Arabia. This was today, calling on Saudi Arabia to release 10 activists and cooperate with the UN-led investigation into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So, you know, I'm not expecting the Saudis to do that, but this is what the rest of the world is calling for. The Daily Beast is reporting that officials and staffers at the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh said that they were not given any details of, you know, of Jared Kushner's trip to Saudi Arabia last week when he went and hung out with Mohammed bin Salman. This is according to three different sources familiar with the trip, and that is causing Congress and people in the embassy to be very worried about, you know, what is Jared Kushner talking to this young princeling about? Meanwhile, an American woman from Washington State who taught at a women's university in Saudi Arabia after she married a Saudi businessman and gave birth to a daughter, you know, the two of them, she got a divorce while in Saudi Arabia. And now, quoting Ben Hubbard, the New York Times, because of the kingdom's so-called guardianship laws, which give men great power over women, she is unable to use her bank account. This American citizen is unable to leave Saudi Arabia. She's unable to travel with her doctor or even seek legal help. She is completely stuck. Her husband's let her residency visa expire, meaning she's lost access to her bank account. She can't get authorization to leave the country. This is absolutely terrible. And then, of course, Mark Sumner over at Daily Kos writing, and the kind of the headline says the whole thing, is Jared Kushner himself responsible for the dismemberment and death of the reporter Jamal Khashoggi? And that, plus yesterday's Washington Post, or day before yesterday's Washington Post editorial board op-ed, Google and Apple are letting men surveil women in Saudi Arabia. There's an app that women have to use to get permission from men to do things like leave the house. And, you know, Google and Apple are apparently all in on this, and they're being called out by the Washington Post. So some really startling news about Saudi Arabia. Stick around, we'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. I was just going through the list of some of the issues in Saudi Arabia, but and we'll get back to that a little later on in the program. But right now on the line with us is a presidential candidate, Marianne Williamson, the author, lecturer, activist. Marianne for America is the website.com. You can tweet her at Mar Williamson, excuse me, M-A-R Williamson. She's just an absolutely wonderful and brilliant person and an old friend. And Marianne, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I feel the same way about you, you know, although my website is Marianne2020.
Marianne2020, thank you very much. Yeah, that makes sense for the campaign, and thank you for that. So tell us, I know you've been traveling the country, you've been in Iowa, you've been a lot of other places. What are you hearing as you're traveling around the country? And B, how does that integrate with your campaign platform? What specifically are you running for president on? What are you campaigning on?
Well, I've gone around the country talking about how very much we have swerved and deviated from the better angels of our nature, both governmentally and economically. And I certainly feel heard when I talk about that. I talk about the fact that short-term profit maximization for multinational corporations has not only corrupted our government to make that our bottom line, has not only corrupted our government, but has hijacked our value system, that this has gone on to such an extent that basically we have reverted to an aristocratic system, and that our generation has to do what other generations, not only other generations have done, but what our original founders had to do, which was decide, do you want to take a stand for democracy and repudiate aristocracy, or do you want to continue with an aristocratic situation? Because that's basically what has happened here. And I feel hurt. And I feel that my message that the traditional political conversation represents too narrow a container for the energies that we need to release at this time. If all you're talking about fixing things on the outside, if all we're talking about is incremental change, if all we're talking about is dealing with the pain but not really challenging the forces that cause all that pain, all we're doing is delaying the catastrophe, and that it's time for a real uprising of consciousness that will lead to the kind of fundamental repair that is needed. Yeah, I feel hurt, and I feel energized, and I feel glad that we're doing this.
That's great. And you feel heard, H-E-A-R-D, as in listened to.
H-E-A-R-D. Right?
Yeah. So you want to run through some policy specifics? Have you developed a platform?
Sure, absolutely. It begins, of course, with the fact that an individual who doesn't care about other people is a sociopath. And so an economic system, the whole trickle-down canard, in which fiduciary responsibility to stockholders is placed before any sense, in fact, to the exclusion of any sense of moral or ethical responsibility to people and to planet, is a sociopathic economic system. Once people understand that, then we understand that it's a subtle form of tyranny which makes all of these other things what they are, beginning with the fact that we have millions of American children who are living in chronic trauma, Tom. There are millions of American children who go to school every day in schools that don't even have the minimum safety standards on the buildings or the minimum school supplies necessary to teach a child to read. And if a child does not learn to read by the age of 8, the chances of their high school graduation is drastically diminished. The chances of their incarceration is drastically increased. I know you know all this. These neurologists tell us that the PTSD that is experienced by these children is no less severe than the PTSD of a returning Afghan or Iraq vet. In fact, it's not post-traumatic in their case, it's present trauma, because it's triggered and re-triggered every day. These children live in America's domestic war zones, where the violence is so great on a daily basis in their homes and their families. We need massive resources for these children, wraparound services, conflict resolution, restorative justice techniques, nutrition. These children are living in such chronic trauma. We should be rescuing them from the poverty on every level that they're experiencing, no different than we would rescue American citizens from any form of natural disaster. But because these children they're not old enough to vote, so they don't represent a constituency. They're not old enough to work, so they have no financial leverage. And in a system such as ours, where the government acts practically like a system of legalized bribery, what possible a chance do these children have to compete with the clout of the corporate forces and their economic power in Washington? That's number one. We need a department and a whole cabinet-level department of childhood and youth. We need a completely massive realignment of our investments in the direction of children 10 years old and younger. I think that Americans, 40 years is long enough for the jury to be in. Our economic system has proven it has nothing to do with planning for economic good 10 years from now. All it is something which steals from the future for short-term profit in the present. So we need to have an economic system. If you want to plan for economic good 10 years from now, you take better care of your 10-year-olds today. We need to have, and for me, the whole idea of where financial abundance comes from is from unleashing the spirit of the American people. You know, we cap people's dreams, Tom, you know, starting with childhood. So there needs to be such an entirely different reframing of what it takes to create an abundant society 10 years from now, what it would take to create a peaceful planet 10 or 20 years from now, at a time and in a situation where, once again, you know, the current head of the Defense Department was a 30-year executive at Boeing. Our defense strategy has nothing to do with peace creation, does it? It's all about preparedness for war, all about short-term profit maximization for people such as Boeing, and not all about. But when you look at what actually wages peace, expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, ameliorating unnecessary suffering wherever possible because large groups of desperate people should be seen as a national security risk, this kind of shift into a robust partnership between making sure we're prepared for war, we must have the best surgeon if, God forbid, we have to have surgery, but we want to create health in the body and we want to create peace in the world. And that should happen not robust humanitarian and diplomatic work on the part of the State Department, but also a U.S. Department of Peace. We are living, and I know I'm not telling you anything you don't already know or that your listeners don't already know, but we are living at a time where our behavior is literally imperiling not only the future of our democracy, but quite possibly the future of life on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's truly remarkable. Marianne2020 is the .com is the website. We're talking with Marianne Williamson. Marianne, we have a little less than a minute left. How did your you ran for Congress from California some years ago, and I'm sure you learned a lot from that campaign. Typically, that's what happens. How is that? You know, what are you applying to this campaign for president right now out of that?
Well, I'm the same person, but I know a little something about political campaigns now, and I didn't then. And like you said, you know, that's how you learn. You know, Obama's first congressional campaign, he lost by 30 points. You can learn from failure.
Lincoln, too.
From success, and yeah, well, so many times.
Yeah.
So hopefully I have learned, but I'm the same woman. It's not that I've gotten any better or worse, but the country sure has gotten worse.
Yeah, tragically. Marianne Williamson, the website, Marianne2020.com. I have that right?
You do.
I do. Okay,
thank
great.
You, Tom. And you,
thank you, Marianne.
You so much,
and you can tweet her at M-A-R Williamson is the Twitter handle as well. So check it out. Marianne Williamson running for president of the United States. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after this break at the bottom of the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just wanted to give you some updates on the United States' ongoing war against people of color. In the Stephon Clark case, he was, of course, killed by a police officer in Sacramento. DA's office decided not to prosecute the police officer. But then they went a step beyond that. Anne-Marie Schuber, who is the Sacramento County District Attorney, held a press conference. This is a few days ago. This was on the 5th. Today is the 7th. Held a press conference in which she announced that they weren't going to prosecute because they, you know, the cops actually in good faith thought that his cell phone in his hand was a gun, quack, quack, quack. You know, we've heard that before. But then she goes off on this rant about what a nasty guy Stephon Clark was, you know, citing things that I'm not even going to quote that had absolutely nothing to do with you know, his being shot and killed by a police officer. The family had not been given a heads up. They were there. It just stunned everybody. You know, this, you know, number one. Number two. Lawton Child Middle Academy in Lakeland, Florida. A young man was arrested, a sixth grader was arrested because he refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Not expelled, not punished, not sent to the back of the room, not sent to the principal's office, although all those things would be wrong too, but arrested, a child, a young African-American child. And this is on February 4th. And it only really, you know, came to a head because Jay-Z's group, Team Rock, from Rock Nation Entertainment Company, got involved and started, you know, talking about this in social media. And so in the letter to his mother, Dakira Talbot, the county's teen court said there are no pending issues now. So they're dropping charges against the sixth grader. Jeez, how generous of them. Meanwhile, on Tuesday in Boulder, Colorado, a black man was out in front of his house, or his building. I think it's a multi-person dwelling, maybe an apartment building or a small, you know, a building that has multiple people living in it, picking up trash in his own yard, literally in his own front yard, picking up trash with a trash bag in one hand and one of those things that have the, you know, the extension on the end, like the, you know, that you can pick up trash with. And a police officer shows up and says, you know, prove to me that you live here. He shows him his ID. The cop doesn't believe him and calls a couple of friends. And now you got three cops holding this guy at gunpoint. There's a 16-minute video of it that's gone viral. And this in Boulder, Colorado. I mean, this is just absolutely bizarre. And finally, the officer who shot and killed a motorist in 2015, a stranded black motorist. His name was Raja Jones, and his SUV had broken down, and this out-of-uniform police officer pulled over next to where Jones's car was, got out, and came at him with a gun. And he was out of uniform, and he didn't display a badge and didn't identify himself. And Jones, who has a legal concealed carry permit, thought he was being carjacked. He's sitting in his car, literally on the phone talking to AAA, and he sees a guy coming at him with a gun pointed at him. And so he takes his gun out of the glove compartment and puts it in his lap. The cop gets up close enough to see that there's a gun in the guy's lap and just starts shooting over and over and over again and killing this guy. And this Palm Beach officer was actually found guilty of manslaughter yesterday. So I guess there is some justice in the United States, although this just never should have happened in the first place. He would not, you know, the cop would not have been shooting had it been a white person. I mean, we know this. Anyhow, to your calls. Tim in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I listened to your the hour with Congressman Pocan, and you were talking about the distribution of wealth and how the billionaires want to keep their every dime they make.
Right.
You know, it's kind of interesting because I've talked to you before about the first 20 years of the 20th century after the McKinley assassination, which was a remarkable time in this country. And in 1914, this is classic because it has a lot to do with what could transpire today. Henry Ford basically doubled the wages for his employees and reduced their hourly day from 9 to 8 hours. And what they were able to do, go out and purchase the products they were building.
Right.
You see what I mean?
And that was Ford's defense when Horace Dodge sued him, and it went to the Michigan right. Supreme Court in Dodge versus Ford back during that period of time. And Ford won. And by the way, the part of history that is typically not told around that story, Tim, is that Henry Ford actually opposed this.
And he had
a business partner whose name is escaping me, who became a state senator in Michigan and was very, very progressive. And his wife was actually very progressive.
Right.
And his business partner and his wife, basically, his business partner talked him into it, and his wife essentially threatened him. There are even stories she threatened to kick him out of the bedroom.
Right, and it changed the labor force, is basically what it did.
It did, and it turned out to be a great thing for Ford, even though, you know, Henry himself was totally opposed to it. Because Henry was no big fan of his workers, and just like he was no big fan of people of color and Jews, and, you know, he was a...
Right, and who was against it, too? His son, Edsel.
I'm not surprised.
We had a poor working relationship with for many years. Henry wanted to keep the Model T going. Edsel introduced the Model A and really changed the company. So
but
that shows you how one significant thing in a labor force can change the world. You know what I mean?
Amen. Well said, Tim.
Amazing stuff.
Yep, it really is. Thanks a lot for the call and for the flash to the past there. Joan in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Joan, what's
on your
mind
today? Oh, my God, Tom, I can't believe it. Anyway, thank you so much for keeping us sane. It's just, we're just hovering on the edges of hell every day. But I want to thank you for everything. But the thing I need to know is I'm afraid we're getting awfully close to these June debates with our lovely candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know the deal on that. I was going to kind of wait to see, you know, who kind of comes up top.
Right.
But I think it says something about $65,000 from 200 donors in 20 states in order to be eligible for the first two debates, or 1% in three approval polls. Can you just expand on that and start advertising or something, or just give me some more insight on what we should be doing?
Your numbers sound more specific than my memory. I thought it was 65,000.
Okay, I may be wrong. That's what I got off the internet today. And
yeah,
I mean,
well,
I don't really
it may
know
well be
what
true, and I need to look it up so that I, you know, because I did mention this a couple days ago, but I was running off memory, and sometimes that's a dangerous thing to do.
I love your Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, she's great, and if you want to see her in the debates, then, you know, a $1 donation is the, you know, I think they're looking not just at the amount of money that you raise, but the big key is the number of donors. So,
we can do a whole bunch of donations. So
yes.
Could you just tell us what to do when you get a chance?
Sure. Well, I can tell you, you know, just broadly speaking, I have made small donations. I'm talking, you know, $25, $50. And
to different people.
To now three or four different Democratic candidates. And,
yeah.
And I do okay. I can afford to do that. If I didn't make a good living and you know, like that, I could have just made them $5 contributions, which in terms of the numbers would have been equally consequential. And these are people that I think that their voices need to be heard in the Democratic debates, period, no matter what. And
will they put on the internet where they are in their standings, that they're getting close or what?
I don't know. You'd have to look at their individual websites. Mary Ann's is Mary Ann 2020. Okay. I think everybody else's are pretty intuitive, you know, BernieSanders.com.
Okay. I think we should get on that.
Warren.com, things like that. Yeah, absolutely. And that's and once you get on these people's mailing list, you know, they'll just come right out and tell you, hey, we're trying to hit this goal because, you know, we want to make it into the Democratic debates, which is really important. So, Joan,
yes,
thank you very much for the call. I gotta move along, but thank you very much. That's a good one. Rudy in Riverdale, Georgia, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Rudy, what's up?
Tom, you know, when I hear of these killings of black men, you know, it cuts to the core. I mean, I just can't explain. You know, it has to be some reason why a white man, like you just explained, this guy's sitting on the side of the highway and a cop just comes and just unloads in his car.
Yeah.
That takes heart. That takes, in my frame of thinking, that takes extreme thought process.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this.
At least this cop is going to prison, Rudy.
Well, I mean, I understand that. I mean,
the first cop in 30 years in Florida,
yes,
who's going to prison for something like this.
Yeah. So, I mean, in my mind, I'm trying to rationalize why white men do this. All right.
It's
so
fear.
I'm going to ask this question. Yeah. Well, no, I'm going to ask this question, though.
Because,
I mean, I don't know if it's controversial or not, but is it something that could be like an interracial marriage when a white man sees a black man with a white woman? Because I've seen that visceral look in a white man's face when he see a mixed couple. So, because I'm just trying to understand, Tom, why black men are getting killed at clips like this. And nothing's being done about it.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Well, increasingly things are being done about it, but it shouldn't be that there needs to be anything done about it because it shouldn't happen in the first place. And Rudy, I have no idea if interracial, you know, I don't think that interracial marriage has anything to do with this. But.
Well, I mean, no, but this doesn't make sense.
Oh, I think you know, you've got 400 years of genocide and literal slavery followed by something damn close to slavery followed by massive discrimination and institutional suppression of wealth and opportunity, which literally continues to this day, and then at the same I can't summarize the whole race situation in the United States in 30 seconds, but. Rudy, thank
you
for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The biggest bottom line is that white people have to start paying attention to this stuff. They have to wake up to what their own privilege is, and the number one part of their own privilege is that they don't have to think about this. And welcome back. Donald in Tascadero, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind today?
I'm doing fine. I'm calling from Car Crazy, California, with an idea for a bumper sticker.
Okay.
As said, would you buy a used car from Donald?
would you buy a used university from him? Would you buy a used vodka?
Car Crazy, California, that's all we think about our cars. So would you buy one from him?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one, Donald. Thank you very much for that. Emmanuel in Chicago. Hey, Emmanuel, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
First of all, I want to thank you. I have great respect for the work you do. Secondly, I wanted to talk about the phrase social capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans are starting to bandy about with this word socialism, but In fact, this is not a true capitalistic country. So if the Democrats start talking in terms of capitalistic socialism, then they could frame the argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, you know, Emmanuel, there's already this, you know, this phrase out there, democratic socialism, that Bernie has embraced, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others have embraced. And so I think that probably our time is best spent rather than trying to come up with a new version of it. In Europe, it's referred to as being a social democrat as opposed to a democratic socialist. And arguably, that's where Bernie should have started. But he's been calling himself a democratic socialist for 50 years, so it wasn't going to change.
I was thinking strictly in terms of the economics of it all, because some of the people who are scared of the phrase are scared because of the economic issue.
Yeah.
So I was thinking in terms of the economic issues, maybe capitalistic socialism or social capitalism would include the two phrases that is truly what America is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I think it's an excellent point. But you and I, Emmanuel, are not going to be successful in rolling out a new phrase that will be adopted by the Democratic Party.
Well, I thought you could be.
Well, no,
I couldn't be.
You're overestimating my impact. A lot of progressives listen to this show. You know, Talkers Magazine estimates our audience at around 5 million or 6 million people. But and I think it's probably somewhat smaller than that, but still, it's a lot of people listening to this show. But that's not enough to change.
You're so popular. People love you so much.
Well, thank you, Emmanuel.
I was hoping that maybe you could have an impact.
But. Yeah, it's really not enough to change the Democratic Party. What I think what I think we need to do, and there are other issues too where I think their messaging is off and you know, that are pretty vital. What I think we need to do is start using the word socialism more frequently and use it in the context of things that people like. Say, you know, how do you like your socialist Medicare? How do you like your socialist Social Security? How do you like your socialist public schools? How do you like your socialist fire department, police department? How do you like your socialist public roads? How do you like, you know, how do you like the fact that, you know, you can get a socialist primary education? You know, these are all socialism. How do you like your socialist parks in your town? And the more often we say those things, then, you know, when Trump, as he did today, he sent me an email today saying the Democrats' platform is socialism, all socialism. Send us some money right away so we can fight them to stop America from turning into Venezuela. That's essentially what Trump's email to me today, or to Fred Flintstone today, said. And they're going to use the word socialism as a cudgel, as a stick, you know, to beat us up with. And we need to be educating people about it. Emmanuel, thank you for the call. Let's check in with Bob Ney and Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. Bob is the author of Sideswipe, former congressman from Ohio. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So what's at the top of the hit parade for the news today?
Well, several things. The Lou Dobbs scenario, which is fascinating because Lou Dobbs is angry at President Trump, and we all know that President Trump watches Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs is his favorite. I don't know if he still is, but he watches him all the time. And Lou Dobbs was very upset because CEOs, including the U.S.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You just bounced out there. Lou Dobbs is very upset because what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Lou Dobbs is very upset because the CEOs from different companies and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in conjunction with an event they had, came to the White House, and when they showed up, they had made some comments about how they were happy with the fact that Ivanka Trump must be in this issue, Tom, that Ivanka Trump and the president were taking a look at least of the immigration that would be deemed legal immigration. Now, these would be people that come in on the H-1B visas, you know, to work in businesses.
To work at Mar-a-Lago.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, work in Mar-a-Lago.
I mean, Trump's got hundreds of these people.
I think those are more blue-collar, you know, with the Mar-a-Lago, but then there's the high-tech, you know, white-collar people that come in. And so
is the bottom line here, Bob, that, you know, Lou Dobbs, I've been at a couple of conventions with him back in the day, you know, these immigration conventions, and he's always basically hated the idea that anybody who comes into this country who's not, you know, white European would have an opportunity to be a U.S. citizen. Is that the bottom line here, is that he doesn't even want legal immigration?
Yes. He is a restrictionist. Now, there are restrictionist groups. Let me make it clear. I'm not saying that Lou Dobbs is a member of that group, but he is what we are deeming these days in the media to be restrictionists.
Interesting.
Those are people who do not want legal immigration. They don't want you to be able to come here legally, say you've been here 15, 20 years, and you can't bring your mother or your father, you can't bring your sister, you can't bring anyone with you.
Right.
In fact, you wouldn't even be able to bring one of your own children that were not born here.
So in other words, under Lou Dobbs' scenario, Melania Trump could not have come to the United States, and then she could not have brought her parents
Correct.
And have them become naturalized citizens.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's
okay.
no doubt about it.
And she couldn't have had baby that she and Donald
right.
have.
Right. And that's
to,
the way
to use
he feels,
Lou Dobbs' so. Language.
Right. So he's attacking the president over. Now, okay. we all know the president went off the teleprompter at the State of the Union and said he wanted to bring the highest numbers ever. Now, there is an issue that you and I have chatted about, about embassies, and we can get into that down the road, but there's some embassy issues. What are our embassies doing? They're kind of following the Lou Dobbs pattern, I believe, where they're restricting the legal ability of people to come in here, people to get married, people that come in on student visas. And I think that's going on already
huh.
with the Trump administration. So the president says one thing and he's doing another, but Lou Dobbs is not happy.
Yeah, okay. What else is up?
Well, and then the other thing is that the issue... there was just a recent press event, well, not a press conference, but Speaker Pelosi in her weekly press deal was saying that they will be voting now on a resolution because, you know, this has been going on and on. It's turned into an agony situation in a sense internally within the Democratic side. But there will be a vote. It'll be on a resolution that will go beyond anti-Semitism. It'll go into Islamophobia. I think they might involve the Latino issue and definitely white supremacy. So I think it's kind of a compromise because this is the second resolution. There was one February the 13th, and now this one, which has caused a lot of angst within the
Democratic Yeah, and there's this huge move now, kind of sweeping the progressive movement in particular. I stand with Ilhan Omar. You know, it's become a hashtag even, so... We'll see how this plays out.
Right, and we'll see how it plays out. And when you look at the issue itself, frankly, you know, people calling for people not to be on the committee. Let's say that hypothetically 100%, which I don't personally believe in analyzing this, but let's say that hypothetically 100%, she made a statement that would be anti-Semitic. Hypothetically, if she apologizes for that statement, then why would anyone want to throw her from a committee? This is a different scenario.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's passing resolutions as a consequence of Steve King's racist stuff or Steve Scalise, running for Congress saying that he's David Duke without the hood. And, and Scalise, by the way, is one of the guys who's now calling for her. He's, in fact, is he not the guy who said she shouldn't have access to intelligence information on that committee, on that Foreign Relations Committee?
Correct. And
crazy.
This is, frankly,
the guy's a bigot
out there. Well, this is so overblown. Now, there have been scenarios that have never hit publicly, Tom, in the past with members of Congress where you dare question anything. I myself was hit up because I wasn't wanting to support a certain measure to deny certain medical benefits through sanctions and to not have Iranians have medical equipment taken away.
Right.
And so sometimes these things start, but this one surfaced way to the front, bubbled up over way over what it should have been.
Yeah, I think so.
Way over.
I absolutely agree, and I think it's ultimately, in some ways, it's good to open the conversation about the difference between criticizing
Correct.
Israel and being anti-Semitic. And on the other hand, it's really sad that it got to this. Bob, thanks a lot.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.